to me, the best part of a meeting outside of being with friends is the lead and the speaker, and it is my distinct honor and privilege, and it is an honor and a privilege. I forget that sometimes when I'm asked to do that stuff, but it certainly is. I met Rita last night for the first time, and I immediately liked her. I don't know too much about her, but I know that when she's finished speaking, I'll feel like we've been friends for all of her life anyhow. She works for the World Service Office. She's a conference administrator. I'm real anxious to find out what that is exactly. So we'll all find out together. So here's Rita.
First of all, I would like to thank you and congratulate you on your most successful up to this point. I've really enjoyed being here, and I've said to Kitty that what I'd really like to do is come back next year and enjoy it in a more relaxed manner. You've all been wonderful, most hospitable, and I've enjoyed meeting each one of you. I do get an opportunity as conference secretary and working for the World Service Office to travel, and it's exciting, but it's also scary. And so I've developed something for myself, a little aid that I use when I travel. And each morning when I leave my room, I ask God to help me to meet the people that I need to be with today. And so when I came to this conference, and I think you announced today there were 418 people here, I wonder why it is that there were probably only 20 of you that I got to know well. And those things mean a lot to me spiritually. And it seems that the 20 people I meet, I re-meet, or I meet people that know them. And my Al-Anon world just keeps expanding and expanding. And it's really a wonderful experience. I wanted to impress you by memorizing something, but I'm sure that I would have messed it up. So I just want to read something to you. And this also happens to me when I travel. I happen to be reading a local Long Island paper. They had an article on West Virginia, and I said, oh, I must tell the people this. It was something that they had written there. It says, we were on the backs of two good horses, and Jess and I could not agree as to our destination. Jess wanting to go to Kentucky, and I into West Virginia. Coming to the forks in the road, we agreed to let the horses decide which road we should take through the wilderness. We laid the reins of the horses' withers, and the horses, with uncommon good sense, chose the road to West Virginia. My apologies to Kentucky. Life has tremendous meaning for me today because of AA and Al-Anon. It gave me an opportunity to learn how to live. Before Al-Anon, there was no Rita. There was a body that existed in this world, but I didn't know what the insides of that person was. I think if I could describe myself, I would say that I was dying from the inside out. I was born into a family of three children, and I was the oldest. I was the favorite of the alcoholic who happened to be my father. And so I started out between a rock and a hard place. I think we try not to label our children, but somehow I was labeled the responsible one. Our home was like a war zone, and I really identified with the Alateen kids that spoke yesterday. Not that I was like them. I could never express my feelings the way they did. But of course, there was no Al-Anon at that time. There were many, many battles in our house. And I was the child that was called down in the middle of the night because there would be less violence if I was there to witness it. And I was terrified. I remember one night I wasn't called down and there was a battle going on. And many, many cruel things were said in the house. But I think this was the cruelest. My father said to my mother, The only reason I married you was that the women in your home, in your family, died before they were 35. And I internalized that, and I was not a very healthy person. I grew up insecure, unsure of myself, not knowing how to be a friend, always wanting to have friends. My best friend lived through my yard, you can go into her yard, and I was there all the time, and we would make little plans. And if my father came home drunk, I would go over and pick a fight with her. I mean, it's a wonder that girl isn't a schizophrenic. She just never knew. And then when she would get mad at me, I couldn't understand why. I had an opportunity, maybe 2 or 3 years ago, to meet this girl again. And I did a fifth step with her. And it was very interesting. She never said whether she knew my father was an alcoholic or not. It was living with this nameless shame. It was a secret that I was bound to keep. Nobody told me I had to do that. I just knew that this wasn't going on in anybody else's house. I grew up to go into high school, and that didn't seem to improve things too much. It was wartime. My father was working in the Virginia shipyard sometimes. Sometimes he was up in Alaska on the Alcan Highway, and those were the happiest times of my life, times when that he was out of the house. I used to beg my mother to leave my father, and yet I wanted him there. From being his favorite, and I knew he always loved me, I began to hate him. And he would get, every time he was leaving, he would say, come up and help me pack. And I was delighted. And he used to pay me besides. And he would say to me, do you know that I could stop drinking anytime I want to? But I don't because of your mother. And I didn't understand what was going on. In high school, I thought I was too tall, believe it or not, too thin, too everything that was not the right thing. And so it was not a pleasant experience, and as you know, alcoholism was progressing. I graduated from high school. I didn't ever seem, you know, when we go to meetings or when I hear the alcoholics speak, as bad as their life was, they always had a direction. They knew what, if they never attained it, they at least knew what their dream was, what their desire was. They wanted to be a lawyer, or they wanted to be a doctor, or they wanted to be a chemist, or whatever it was. I didn't seem to have this direction in my life. I thought it would come in the form of some kind of an opportunity that would knock on my door. Well, after high school, having had no direction, and the good nuns always saying, if you don't get a New York State Regents diploma, you're going to get married, and someday you're going to want to go to college, and they won't take you. I mean, this was the big fear in my life, that I wasn't going to get this Regents diploma, and that I was going to get married. I mean, it was just unreal. I had really no set idea of going to college or not going to college. And at this time, a lot of the men were coming home from the service, and believe it or not, Long Island was rural at that time, and the boys in high school were dismissed at harvest time and planting time, and it was a very mixed bag of, you didn't go on to school, you just went off to work somewhere. And so I graduated, and it was sort of, well, here I am world. But I remember 2 weeks before I graduated, my father said to me, if you'd like to go to college, somehow we'd manage. Well, my father, I think, had gone to the sixth grade, and my mother to the eighth, and they were in awe that I had gone to high school and knew nothing about guiding somebody to go to college. And I had come out of a Catholic high school with my navy blue uniform with the white blouse. And I had these romantic ideas about college and, you know, cashmere sweaters and plaid skirts, and That was a reason you couldn't go. I mean, I didn't have that. I couldn't go in my uniform. I didn't have a car. I didn't know how I was going to go there. I said, no, I'll go to work. And in high school, all the girls had to take shorthand and typing, so I did have a little business background. And I went and applied for a job, and they said, well, we don't have any typing or shorthand. Would you like to work in the mail room? And I was just thrilled to get a job, and I worked there under very, very poor conditions. If any of you have ever belonged to the Doubleday Book of the Month Club, I probably opened your letter and took your check out of there. And we were not allowed to talk or chew gum. We had to open 3,000 letters a day, and it was worse than being in school. But this friend of mine who lived near me had gone on to Georgetown University to become a nurse, and she had to go to the local church to ask the priest for some sort of a form for him to sign, and I went along. And I had just left this job. Actually, I had been asked to leave, or it was suggested that I leave, because somebody told them I wanted to start a union there. I mean, I didn't even know what they were talking about. So I went along with my friend, and while I was there, the priest said to me, what are you doing now? And I said, well, I'm looking for work. And he said, well, there's somebody in our parish here who works down on Wall Street for the personnel director of a brokerage firm, and she's leaving to have a baby, and she just happened to say, you know, do you know anybody who would like the job? So he arranged for me to talk to this girl. I didn't know what brokerage was. I had no idea where Wall Street was. And so, but I said I would. I didn't know what else to do. And the appointment was arranged. Now, I had an Uncle Frank who lived with me, or with us, who drove a subway in New York City. So Uncle Frank took me to Wall Street on the subway and waited for me outside. And I went up, and the personnel director's name was Mr. King, and we discussed. I interviewed him, is actually what happened. I loved him immediately. He had a big soup stain on his tie. And he lived on Long Island, and we discussed a lot of things, and he wanted to hire me, and I said to him, well, how much dictating do you do? And he was saying, I think he really wanted to hire me. He said, well, not that much, but sometimes, you know. And I'm saying, well, how fast do you talk? And this went on and on, and finally at the end, I said, I really didn't think I could handle the job. I couldn't even get there. And he suggested that I go back to secretarial school, and that when I finished, he would have a job for me. And that night, his secretary called me and said he had had other thoughts, and he wanted me to come in there and work, and they would send me to school. So it was an excellent opportunity. And I decided I would not take the subway to New York. I would take the Long Island Railroad, which is a step above nothing. Now, I took the train to Brooklyn, and I had to take a subway three stops after I got off the train. And this is how I did that. Got off the train, and I followed distinguished-looking gentlemen with briefcases, who I assumed were going to Wall Street. No. They all went to Brooklyn. And I would say, well, this is the third stop and this is not Wall Street, and I would go up and I would find a telephone and I would call my boss, who was also a very nice man, and I would tell him I'm on the corner of Skirmahorn or something like that. He would say, well, you go back down and you whatever. And what he said to me was, I would get there about, the market opened at 10, I would get there about 10:30, and at that time the market closed at 3, and about 2 o'clock he would say, why don't you start home? And I was very conscientious and responsible, and I'd say, no, it's quite all right. And he said, I'd really like you to get home before dark. What also happened when I worked in New York, I always felt better when I was out of my own home territory, and I met young ladies there, young single ladies, who would go up to a place called Jug and Barn. I don't know if any of you are familiar with it. It's up in Massachusetts, and all the single people went up there. And to describe it, there was a huge rec hall, they called it, that was probably six times as large as this room, and it was a bring-your-own-bottle place, so I can tell you what the main thing that they did there was. And when you checked out, you just told them how many sodas you had or whatever, and there was a lot of drinking going on. And I went up there many times, but on this particular time, guess who was there? And he asked me if he could see me when we got back in New York. Now, logistically, dating would have been difficult because I lived on Long Island and he lived in Upper Manhattan and he didn't have a car. But we did find out that he worked just a few blocks from Wall Street, and we mainly were dated in New York City. And then he would put me on the last train out to Long Island. And this suited me fine because he didn't have to come to my home. There was always a lot of, I don't know, although I wanted to date, it got to be a hassle. I could fight with my girlfriend, but having a date and then calling the guy up and making these crazy excuses was really not what I wanted to do. So this arrangement worked out very well. And we dated, as I say, in the city, and then he put me on the train, and what I didn't know was that he drank after he put me on the train. Now, I said I had no hopes and dreams or plans for myself, but I did make myself one promise, and that was I would never marry a man who drank. Now, I didn't understand alcoholism, and I didn't understand the progression of the disease, and what I really meant was I would never marry a man who drank like my father. And, of course, my father's progression was much greater than my husband's. And so we dated for 2.5 years. And I never saw Joe drunk except once, and that was at a wedding. And my life experience is that every wedding I went to, the men in my family got drunk. And so I just thought, well, you know, he doesn't drink other times. And then we started talking about getting married. And I had this lump in my throat and this pain in my heart because I didn't know how to tell him that my father had a drinking problem. So what better place to discuss this than a cocktail lounge? And we were sitting there talking about it, and I finally said, you know, I think my father has a drinking problem. And Joe said, oh, my father had a drinking problem. My father died of alcoholism. Well, I also knew his father had diabetes, so I figured it was related, and it had nothing to do with my father and my father's drinking. And then Joe said something to me. He said, you know, sometimes I even think I have a problem with drinking. And I thought to myself, he doesn't even know what he's talking about. I mean, drinking. I mean, I really know what drinking is. And I just dismissed that. Well, needless to say, we were in love and we were married. And I remember on our honeymoon, an uncle of mine who bottled soda was at a cork and bottle convention down in Florida where we were, and the Fontainebleau Hotel was brand new and the place to be, and he invited us to a big party there. And before we went to the party, Joe said to me, you know, getting married and all these preparations have really worn me down. He said, you know, tonight I'd really like to just go out and get drunk. And I said, great, and I'll get drunk tomorrow. I never got my turn. I thought something was weird. He was walking around with this coconut, and he checked it in the hat check. It was really wild. And I, you know what I was? I was what you were. I was embarrassed. And when we got in the cab to go back to our hotel with the coconut and all the buttons and all this stuff, I just pretended that we were at a convention and this is what happens and whatever. I mean, I really didn't know how to handle this because it was different being married to an alcoholic than being the child of an alcoholic. Well, We were talking, you know, we had the sex workshop here, and I was very interested in what was going to happen there, because my sex education, I kept waiting for my mother to talk to me, and when she finally talked to me, she said, "Now, Rita, when Daddy and I were married, we were very disappointed that we didn't have you until we were married 4 years, so don't be disappointed if you don't have children right away." That was my sex education. And a year and a day later, our son was born. And Joe and I had moved way out on Long Island before he was born, and that didn't work out too well. We didn't like it there, and so we had this little apartment in Roslyn, and Joe's drinking had escalated, and I thank God we were poor, because I could tell by the amount of money that he had when he left the house what time he would come home. And I think that as bad a drinker as my father was, Joe didn't know my father's tricks of, you know, building up tabs and all that type of thing. So I just have to regress once to tell you who I was and how secretive I was. And it was before the first Christmas that Joe and I were dating, and Joe said he would really like to get something for my mother and father, and he brought my mother a beautiful hand-painted jewelry box that had two little drawers. I still have that, and there was Barasini candy in the drawers. But he couldn't decide what to get my father. And I was with him when we went out shopping, and he said to me, "I think I'll get him a bottle of Old Granddad." And I never said a word. But the interesting thing was, he bought it in a decanter, and you wound it up, and when you poured, it played "How Dry I Am." My father just loved it. Just loved it. But we were living in this little apartment, and Joe's drinking was progressing, and I was regressing. And I thought that when I married, I would no longer have to deal with my father's alcoholism. But you don't ever lose the alcoholics in your life. And he would come and knock on the apartment door, and I would pretend I wasn't home, and I felt terrible. And I now had this child who I wouldn't let him take in the car, which is what my mother did when I was growing up. And I was heartbroken, and I didn't know what to do, and I felt inadequate. And Joe one night said to me, "I think I'm an alcoholic." And I said, "What's that?" He says, "Well, I think that I can never have a drink again." And I said, "You know, Joe, you don't drink like me. I mean, you have one or two. I mean, I really wasn't into this. And I think that this is really a story of an alcoholic who got sober in spite of me." And so he went to a meeting and came home with the big book. Now, I had also decided in all my wisdom that Joe had book learning and I had common sense. And we all know common sense is more important. But he read the book, and I thought he knew it, and he certainly thought he knew it. And he went to meetings sporadically, and things were getting worse and worse at home. Joe had a talk with my mother, and my mother had a talk with Joe. He did tell her he was in AA. Told her about our program, and she said, "How do you think we can help Walter?" And Joe said, "I'm sorry to tell you, he's a hopeless alcoholic." But he did give my mother pamphlets, and somebody was talking about putting the pamphlets in the drawer. My mother put them in my father's underwear drawer and in a sock drawer, and skillfully my father could move things without ever touching the pamphlets. But I tell you this because my father at this time was unemployable. It was so difficult for him to get from our house, which was about 6 blocks from the nearest tavern, that he had taken up residence in somebody's garage. And I was heartbroken. And when he did come home, he would do things like hang a noose from a rafter and say he was going to kill himself. And all the while, I never discussed with my mother how I felt or how we can compare or help each other and I knew nothing about Al-Anon. And I tell you about my father because Joe went out drinking again, and during that time, my father asked for help. And it was the same priest who got me the job in Wall Street who saw my father. And from the day he asked for help, he never had another drink. And so he now celebrates, if he were still alive, a year more sobriety than Joe. And so there are miracles, and there are no hopeless cases. And also my father came into AA, gave he and I another very, very special relationship, because my mother never came to Al-Anon, and my father and I were able to talk program. And I got to know a man who I never, ever would have known had he not had a disease of alcoholism. Joe did go into AA, but I remained the same. I supported him in every way I knew how, and I went to many, many AA meetings. But the group Joe belonged to had two primary purposes. One was to stay sober, and the other was not to let your wife know about Al-Anon. And this was many, many years ago, and Al-Anon was probably rather new, and they used to say, you know, if your wife goes to Al-Anon, all they do is sit around and talk about the alcoholic. And I'm not going to say that they were right or wrong, because I think Al-Anon in its infancy, maybe they did do that. But we used to go to the beach, and you know how AA people, Al-Anon people gravitate together, and all the families would be there, and I would hear that the kids were going to this other Alateen or whatever it was, but nobody ever asked me to go. I think I was suffering from my own particular disease that was called terminal shyness. I could not approach people. I could not ask people for anything. I always stood on the sidelines and waited to be asked. And these ladies would get together. They'd say, well, Wednesday night, why don't we play cards, or why don't we, I think Mahjong was big then or whatever, and they never invited me. And I just thought they didn't like me. But all of these ladies were in Al-Anon. Now, I'm not going to stand here and tell you that they never told me about Al-Anon. But I must have been in a blackout, because I never, never remember them asking me. I do remember my husband's sponsor, who subsequently moved to California, his wife was going to Al-Anon, and they came to dinner one night, and she was saying, some night you have to come to Al-Anon with us, she said, and then we go to Howard Johnson's afterward and have a few drinks. Well, I thought, this is not what I need in my life. And we had one car, and I thought that the car belonged to Joe in case he wanted to go to a meeting. I wanted to do everything to ensure his recovery, because I felt responsible for that too. What then happened is we moved into where we presently live, and the lady next door was a friend, a longtime friend, and she had a husband who drank periodically. She used to call him a pregnant drunk because he'd get drunk about every 9 months. And he was violent, and she knew Joe was in AA, and she thought I was the luckiest woman in the world. But she just didn't know how I felt inside. And when I attended the AA meetings, I would look at those steps, I would stare at them as if I memorized them, my life would change. The only thing I didn't realize was they worked for the people in AA because they were doing it together. And I had nobody to do this with. But this friend came over this particular day, and she said, you know, there was this problem the night before on one thing and another. And out of a clear blue sky, I said to her, well, why don't you go to Al-Anon? And she said, well, what's that? I said, well, I don't know. I said, but we'll find out, and we'll go together. And she went off to her house, which was right next door, and I needed milk or bread or something, and I went down to the supermarket, And I'm in Al-Anon through the grace of public information, because there in the rack where they tell you things for sale, there was an Al-Anon pamphlet and a meeting list. And I took two. And I ran through to her house and I gave her her copies and I said, if you find a meeting, let me know and we'll go together. And she called me later and said, there's a meeting tomorrow night right here in Roslyn. And we went together. And the person who entered that door was a person who never joined anything. It was a person who was terrified that anybody would find out. I was still keeping the secrets from childhood. I mean, if you told me something to tell somebody, I couldn't remember if it was a secret, so I wouldn't tell them. And I went into my beginner's meeting, and I knew the chairman because I knew a lot of people in AA and Al-Anon. And I sat there, and I kept saying over and over again to myself, Rita, 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 just in case they asked me my name. I had no thoughts, I couldn't hear what was going on. And then we went into the regular meeting, which had probably 75 people. And I always made sure that I sat way in the back so nobody would call on me. But my friend decided that we really weren't getting too much out of this, and so we joined a daytime group, and there were probably 12 people. And I remember there were people on there maybe 5 or 6 years, but because they thought I was well. They wanted what I had. You see, I hadn't come into Al-Anon until Joe was sober 12 years. Now, they would say, who's going to make coffee next week? Well, you know I know how to make coffee, but they had one of those coffee urns, one of those big ones, and had a dial on it and everything. And I would never admit I didn't know how to do anything. So I never volunteered to do the coffee. Till one day somebody said, I'll do the coffee again if a newcomer will do it with me. And that's how I began my first service. But there was this very aggressive girl there who was the GR. And I used to say, And she said one day, I have to have an assistant, and she has to go to meetings in Westbury, and Rita, I think you should go. Well, I didn't have to say no to that either, so I became the assistant GR. And then she left, and I became the GR for 3 years. And then another group formed, and they needed a GR, and they asked me if I'd be their GR. So I was GR for 7 years. And that's sort of how I got into service. Now, during this time, there was another lady who was active at the World Service Office, and I think she was on the Board of Trustees or something, and she asked me, didn't I think I'd like to volunteer my time? And I said yes. I always said yes. And she said, well, think of what committee you would like to be on. I didn't even know they had committees. So I just said, okay. And she would call me and say, have you decided? And I said, well, not yet. And finally she said, well, I'm on the forum committee. Do you think you'd like me on the forum committee? I said, sure. And she took me in, and I was on the forum committee a long time. And that really expanded my horizons. When I saw the letters coming in from all over the world, and people seemed to express my feelings better than I could express them myself. And I could see the health and recovery of people who wrote often. But at my first meeting, there was a lady from Pennsylvania. She seemed to like me. She was very friendly, and I liked her. The thing I didn't know that it was that she was Alice Butler, the lady who wrote The One Day at a Time. Had I known that, I never would have gone back. It would have made me feel so insignificant. But she became a very, very good friend of mine, and I was privileged to have worked with her. And through that experience, I was Alice was also the chairman of the Literature Committee, and she decided I should be on the Literature Committee, and from there I was invited on the Board of Trustees and became Literature Chairman. I said my English teacher would die. I mean, she would just die. And went on from there to do many other things at the World Service Office. And the other thing that I did, and it was only through the sharing of other people in Al-Anon, I began to really look at myself and believe that down deep inside of each one of us, we really know who we're supposed to be. And the guidance to take that out of deep down inside of us and bring it to the forefront is a higher power. And I learned that in the Al-Anon rooms. And other people were going on with their life and not managing other people's lives. I could see things that I had done wrong within my own family, thinking that I was doing something for everybody. I think the one thing that I did was I prevented other people in my family from having their own relationship. And I remember once when my son was a teenager, he had done something that he was not supposed to do that really could have been very dangerous. And my husband punished him. And my son the next day was very upset about this and said that he had discussed this with his friends. And his friends had said, being that my husband was a lawyer, he could never rescind his punishment as if he had been a judge. And that he was very upset about this and that he would like to talk to his father. And my son cried. He was heartbroken over this. And I cried. And I kept saying, are you finished now, Mark? And he'd say no, and he would go on and on. And this lasted about an hour and a half. And when he was finished, I said to him, you know, Mark, it occurs to me that now you know this, and I know this. And the only one that doesn't know how you feel is Dad. So later on that afternoon, he said to me, is Dad going to a meeting tonight? And I said, yes. He said, what time will he be home? I said, well, probably 10:30. And he said to me, would you mind going to your room when Dad comes home? He said, you always try to make everything all better. And so I was sent to my room. But he did tell me, I only have one child, and he was probably about 16 or 17 at the time. And he said, you know, Mom, I know I'm your only child, and it would probably break your heart. He said, but I've just got to express myself, and if this doesn't work out, I have to leave home. And I was terrified. And I went to my room, and I could hear my husband come in, and I could hear Mark say, Dad, do you mind if we have a man-to-man talk? And they went into the den, and I did what any mature person would do. I sat on the steps and tried to listen, and I couldn't hear them. And I put a glass to the floor, and I was only getting bits and snatches. I was really just trying to get the tone of the conversation. And then I said to myself, if an Al-Anon person called me and told me what was going on, what would I tell them? And I said I would tell them to say the Serenity Prayer and to go to bed. And I knelt down and I prayed the Serenity Prayer, and I cannot believe I fell asleep, not knowing whether I would have a son there in the morning or not. And I think that was the beginning of their relationship. And I don't even know what their relationship is supposed to be. I hardly know what my own relationship is supposed to be. But they do have a relationship. And I think they love each other very much. But it's very difficult, I think, when you've been brought up in alcoholic home and when you've lived with active alcoholism, to trust the responses of the alcoholic. And that's what I had to do. So I've gotten so much out of Al-Anon in all of these incidences. What happened during when I was on the Board of Trustees, you're given an assignment, you're usually given a chairmanship of a committee. And during this time, one of my assignments was as assistant to the conference chairman. And so for 3 or 4 years, I planned agendas and worked on getting the conference together. Several people have asked me what the conference is, and it's an annual gathering of the delegates from the United States and Canada, at which time policy for Al-Anon is formed and the direction that the office is going to take for the year is formulated. And about 2.5 years ago, while I was still assistant chairman, the lady at the World Service Office, her name is Helen Gimple, and I know she spoke here maybe 4 or 5 years ago. She speaks very highly of West Virginia. Had a stroke, and I was offered the job at the World Service Office. And it was a big decision, because here I was at my tender age going back to New York City, and I might have to follow distinguished-looking men with briefcases again. I will say that through going to meetings, I also got the courage to not go back to college, but to begin college. When my son started college, I went back. And I never gave up my volunteer work at the World Service Office. I think that it's sort of the heartbeat of Al-Anon. It's where everything, all of the feelings come in from all over the world and are weighed and measured and then given out back to the groups again to make decisions. And it's a wonderful opportunity for anybody living near the office to be able to go in there and volunteer their time. And Al-Anon, at these volunteer meetings, especially at the forum, became mini Al-Anon meetings. I mean, I really got to know the traditions when I was on the forum committee, because what is printed in the forum is decided by this committee, and what the people are saying, if it is within our traditions. So I got to know them backwards and forwards. But I just want to tell you about the steps a minute. I love the steps. But if I had my way, I'd change the first step, because it says, we admitted we were powerless, and I'll admit anything, but accepting something is a very different story for me. And when I came into Al-Anon, as I said, Joe was already sober, so I said, sure, I'll admit it. He was sober, and I didn't have to really internalize that. And the second step, what I realize about that is I always had a God in my life. I always had a higher power. But I didn't react to that higher power. The higher power that I reacted to was alcohol and the alcoholic. And I had to take stock of myself and decide who did I want to be my higher power? And after years and years and years of reacting to alcoholism, it's very difficult to change, and I worked on that step a long time. And certainly the third step with insanity, this was one crazy lady. I was just hanging on by a fingernail, just trying to get through each day, dying on the inside. And I just want to tell you two other things. When I came here to Jackson Mill, Jackie took me in her car and took me around to show me the grounds and everything, and she pointed out the chapel. And I said, oh, that's very nice. And then she took me around the second time, and she said, would you like to go in the chapel? And I said, yes. Now, whenever I go anywhere else to speak, I do that thing about being with the people I need to be with. And the other thing I do, if I can, is go into a chapel or a church and pick up a piece of their literature at random and read. And I always get a message. And so we went into the chapel on Friday, and there was a message. I mean, it wasn't even in the book. It was just laying there on the chair, on the pew. And this is what it said. It said, Be strong and courageous. Do not be afraid. And that has carried me through until this morning. And this morning I went back to the chapel. And there was another note. This one I took. And this is what it said. When we do the best we can, we never know what miracle is wrought in our life or in the life of another. And I think that that's my spiritual message for this morning. But lest you think that I have the whole thing put together, I want to tell you, as part of my job, I have to go and look at hotel sites for conferences and regional service seminars. And I was driving up to Connecticut from my home, and you have to go through this, over this bridge, and there's usually long lines. So I got on the long line, and it's a $2 toll. I had $4 in my hand, and I had it all together. I had done my spiritual reading. I had meditated. I had the tiger by the tail. And I said to the woman, I'd like an extra token, so that when I came back, I wouldn't have to get on the long line again. I could just breeze through the toll. And as I came back, there was this almost no line, and I went in and I threw my token in, and the gate didn't go up. Well, I started honking my horn and being indignant, and the gate still didn't go up. And I honked, and they must have some man there that can make that gate go up. And the gate went up, and as the gate went up, the bells went off. And I said, listen, that's their problem. And when I got home, I was getting all my papers together and clearing out my pocketbook. And there was the token. What I had thrown in there was my serenity token. But who knows, whoever counts the tokens there may just be looking for serenity that day. I want to thank you all for letting me share with you. It's been a wonderful, wonderful conference, and I love you all.